News, I'm Tommy McNeil. In American politics, Democrats and Republicans will split control of Congress, with Democrats claiming victory in the U.S. House of Representatives and Representative Nancy Pelosi being Speaker of the House again after several years of Republican leadership.
We will have a Congress that is open, transparent, and accountable to the American people. We will strive for bipartisanship, seeking common ground, as we are responsible to do. But when we can't find that common ground, standing our ground.
And as AP Sagar Magani reports, Republicans will maintain control of the U.S. Senate.
Democrats faced a very narrow path toward regaining the majority, and it closed with losses in Indiana, Tennessee, North Dakota, and Texas, where Ted Cruz beat new Democratic favorite Beto O'Rourke, ending the Democrats' dream of riding anti-Trump sentiment into Senate control.
That's a huge moment, a huge victory for the president.
Spokeswoman Sarah Sanders, who'd earlier said the Democrats might see a ripple, but certainly not a blue wave. Sagar Magani at the White House.
Even after all the votes have been officially counted, there remains a concern of election meddling. Several hours before polls closed, Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen cautioned that the Russians have had a full court press through many means.
Looking at their techniques and tactics and their main goal of sowing mistrust related to our democracy, that, of course, remains a concern of mine, that after everyone has voted, that they would try to make a claim that something went wrong.
Social media companies like Facebook say they acted swiftly to take down what appeared to be deliberate misinformation. Several incidents were referred to law enforcement for investigation. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. U.S. foreign policy hawks who backed the Trump administration's reimposition of sanctions on Iran's energy and banking sectors say there are several ways in which U.S. sanctions may get even tougher. U.S. officials sanctioned Iran's energy and banking sectors Monday, completing a process of reimposing U.S. sanctions that were lifted under Iran's 2015 nuclear deal with the previous Obama administration and five other world powers. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif suggests U.S. foreign policy strategists work on mending earlier blunders rather than following an isolationist agenda.
Rather than relying on its discredited addiction to unilateralism and sanctions as tools of statecraft, which are today pushing it further into global isolation, the U.S. is better off addressing the catastrophes and crises it has engineered in our region.
AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports the State Department says Congress will consider if Russia should face new sanctions and the poisoning of a former spy.
The State Department says under the Biological Weapons Control and Warfare Elimination Act, additional sanctions would be warranted against Russia, which is accused of violating a ban against the use of chemical weapons. Russia, which denies targeting a former spy and his daughter, is already facing U.S. sanctions over its alleged interference in the 2016 election and its actions in Ukraine.
The Taliban officially has confirmed it will attend a multilateral meeting hosted by Russia to discuss Afghanistan, but a spokesman for the insurgent group clarified Tuesday its delegates will not engage in any Afghan peace and reconciliation talks at the Moscow gathering. Moscow has invited 12 nations and the Islamist Taliban to that meeting. The United States and the Afghan government have both turned down that invitation. Facebook is admitting it played a role in the genocide against the Rohingya people of Myanmar. Last August, UN investigators caused a social network of being slow and ineffective in tackling how it was being used to spread hatred among the country's Buddhist population against the minority Muslim Rohingya. In doing so, it contributed to the commission of atrocity crimes. An American citizen charged with mailing pipe bombs to high-profile Democratic politicians and other critics of U.S. President Donald Trump was ordered held without bail Tuesday during his first appearance in federal court in New York. Assistant U.S. Attorney Jane Kim argued that Cesar Sayoc, who was transferred from federal custody in Florida, was a serious risk of danger to the public and a flight risk. He was dressed in navy blue prison overalls and appeared alert and respectful as he went before the U.S. magistrate. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate, Washington. Today's Wednesday, November 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari expresses commitment to an $83 a month minimum wage hike.
Report has been submitted to Mr. President, and he has said that he would act taking the next step so that it is sent to the National Assembly. We hope that the government will live up to his promise and that this will be done quickly.
Peter Ozo-Ison is the Secretary General of the Nigeria Labour Congress. Malawi opposition parties demand the resignation of the country's Election Commission chair. Peace in South Sudan raises the prospect for release of child soldiers. And DRC opposition parties are still in search of a consensus candidate, with official campaign for the December presidential election set to start on November 22nd.
Personally, I'm extremely optimistic that we'll get there, simply because everybody is of the view that none of us going it alone will be able to win.
Freddy Matungulu is the leader of the opposition Congo Nambiso Party. South Sudan's government is urged to include the opposition in national dialogue. And Mauritania is not making progress towards combating slavery. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has expressed his commitment to raise the country's minimum wage to 30,000 naira, or about $83 a month. The Nigerian Labour Congress called a nationwide strike in September to demand the minimum wage increase. The workers suspended its second nationwide strike yesterday to allow negotiations to continue. On Tuesday, President Buhari received the recommendation of a tripartite committee recommending a 30,000 naira minimum wage increase. The current minimum wage in Nigeria is $50. The plan will be submitted to the National Assembly for passage. Peter Ozo-Ison is the Secretary General of the Nigeria Labour Congress. He says the union hopes the government will live up to its commitment.
The report has been submitted to Mr. President, and he has said that he would ask quickly taking the next step so that it is sent to the National Assembly. That's what we expected all along. We hope that the government would live up to its promise and that this will be done quickly. We are happy that we have got to this stage where the report has been submitted.
How soon does the Labour Congress want this to be implemented?
We expect that all this should be concluded within a matter of weeks, and definitely this year, the implementation of the minimum wage will sound expectation. We know that we need to go to the National Assembly. We also know that the National Assembly is capable of giving the bill accelerated hearing that be enacted into law as quickly as possible. So we hope that all this can happen in a few weeks so that implementation can commence.
Break it down for me. 30,000 naira per month, this is an equivalent of what? $83?
Well, the current minimum wage is 18,000 naira. And so the 30,000 naira, we do not believe is a living wage. But given the challenges of the economy at the time, it's like a stop gap measure, and that the spirit of compromise and the spirit of what the economy is facing now challenges.
I was looking at a statement put out by the labor unions, and it says here that arrears of salaries, allowances, and pensions owed on the basis of the 2011 Minimum Wage Act must be paid. What does that mean?
Well, there are some state governments that are arrears of salaries. Those, we believe, that they have not managed their affairs properly. And luckily, we are facing election from 2019. And we expect that citizens will be able to use their electoral power to determine those governors or state governors that have not performed properly and are owing those arrears of salaries. We expect those arrears of salaries to be defrayed. And those governors that refuse to so do, we urge our members to use their voting power to vote them out come 2019.
Peter Ozo-Ison is the Secretary General of the Nigeria Labour Congress. You're speaking with me from the capital, Abuja. Leaders of the Democratic Republic of Congo opposition parties are expected to meet tomorrow, Thursday, in Geneva in their continuing effort to choose a consensus candidate for the December 23rd presidential election. The opposition met in South Africa last month and agreed to name their presidential candidate by November 15th. The time appears to be running out as the official campaigning is set to begin November 22nd. Freddy Matungulu, leader of the opposition Congo Nambiso Party, says he's optimistic the opposition will choose a unified candidate because they understand that no single one person can win the December election.
We're supposed to be going to Geneva either tomorrow or the day after tomorrow for talks over 3 days. And we expect to conclude those discussions with the naming of the one amongst us who will be our standard bearer, the guy who is going to be the one leading us as the opposition, as a group, as we go to that election.
The opposition was in South Africa just last month, but you were not able to choose a candidate. What do you think the people should expect now that you're going to Switzerland?
I don't think we can say that we were not able to choose a candidate of the opposition. We started the discussions, as you know, these are complicated talks, and Pretoria was the first step. And I think we made a lot of progress in Pretoria. The idea is to conclude these discussions in Geneva. This was the end of the week. Personally, I'm extremely optimistic that we'll get there simply because everybody is of the view that none of us going it alone will be able to win. In this country, this big country, no single party can really win a presidential election without getting into a major coalition. We all in the opposition are aware of this. That's the reason why we've decided that we need to go to the selection of that single candidate.
I spoke with you, I think, earlier this month, and you indicated that you promised that the opposition will present a single candidate to the people of the Democratic Republic of Congo by November 15. Do you think the opposition can meet this deadline?
We have no choice but to abide by that deadline. There's a lot of pressure from within in the population. And I think the other reason why we need to do this quickly is because the campaign will soon begin. And as you know, the election is less than 2 months away. So time is running out on us. And that's the reason why this time when we go to Geneva, the idea is really to continue with the discussions, but to conclude everything so that we have a single candidate by the time our discussions are completed.
First, it was South Africa last month. Now it's going to be Geneva, Switzerland. The fact that it's taken this long, is there some disagreement among the different potential leaders of the opposition?
Well, I mean, I think you must be familiar with this sort of talks. You have major parties that are very much present on the political scene, and everybody's got his own base. And the challenge we have here is to put together a coalition that takes into account the concerns of all these different leaders, and it's not an easy task.
Freddy Matungulu is the leader of the opposition Congo Nambiso Party. He was speaking with me from the DRC capital, Kinshasa. Today is Wednesday, November 7th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 14 and a half minutes past the hour. The special representative of the UN Secretary General for Children and Armed Conflict says a chief benefit of peace in South Sudan is the likelihood that a great many child soldiers will be freed and reintegrated into their communities. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
UN Special Representative Virginia Gamba was present during the Khartoum peace process in South Sudan 3 weeks ago. She met with government officials and members of the various warring factions. She visited the camps where she met and talked with child soldiers. All of this, she says, has convinced her that prospects for the separation and release of children are very high. So far this year, she says 900 child soldiers have been freed. If the peace holds, she says it is possible as many as 1,000 more children will be released by the end of the year. Once they are released, she says they must go through a process of integration, and that, she notes, could be problematic.
The fear I have is that the amount of children that will be released in the next few months are such that UNICEF and partners will not have enough resources to handle the reintegration at one go, which means a lot of children are punished by staying in the bush without the chance of reintegration until we have the capacity to absorb them.
Gumba is appealing to the international community to provide aid agencies with the money they need to reintegrate the child soldiers into their communities so they can be given a fresh start. She says recruitment as soldiers is only one of the many violations to which children are subjected. She says acts of violence against children in South Sudan are the worst she has ever seen, including in Afghanistan and Syria. She says gross violations include decapitation, the use of sexual violence against very small children as a weapon of war, abductions, and the forced use of children to support the war effort. She says all of the warring parties, government and rebel forces alike, are guilty of these crimes and must be held accountable for them. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Seven Malawi opposition parties have demanded the resignation of the country's election commission chair, Jane Ansah, and other senior officials of the commission to allow for an independent forensic audit of all electoral equipment to take place. This after a laptop used for voter registration for the 2019 presidential election went missing. The country's elections commission has said the laptop had no election information on it when it went missing. Ibrahim Matola is Secretary General of former President Joyce Banda's People's Party.
The decision is that the MEC should pave way, especially the chairperson and the CEO should pave way for the investigations to take place. Because as the opposition political parties, we're looking for independent investigator so that we can have a clear picture on what happened. At the moment, we don't know what has really happened because the explanation which we got from the Malawi Electoral Commission is not convincing.
The Elections Commission says that this particular equipment has very little information about the election was on that. Why is it that the opposition think that this is very important?
Election is a process, so we cannot be convinced with the information and the response which the Malawi Electoral Commission gave us. In all fairness, these equipment were supposed to be in the custody of the police, but they are still kept by the Malawi Electoral Commission. And also, just to tell us about the book through its cover, it doesn't mean that it's convincing to us. We need to know what is inside, whether they had a drive, and we can have experts to look into that. By the way, also, there is another second machine which went missing in Mzuzu. That's what we are worried, that is MEC really ready to handle these elections.
I understand you're also asking the United Nations for help. What exactly do you want the United Nations to do?
Because these machines were sourced by United Nations UNDP Development Program, which they are the co-funders of the elections. For example, Malawi government supports the elections about 60%, and the 40% comes from the corporate partners, which is VFID, European Union, or European Commission, and also VFID for UK.
What does this cooperation between the opposition parties, what does that mean? Can this type of cooperation lead to, say, a united opposition going into the election?
We are just having a common stand because we have not yet formed electoral alliance. But this is a common alliance on issues pertaining the elections.
So nice to talk with you. Thank you very much for joining us on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you. Norwegians also for giving me this opportunity to share the concern of what is happening here in Malawi. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ibrahim Matola is the Secretary General of former President George Banda's People's Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lusaka. The South Sudan government has been called upon to allow the opposition parties to be part of the peace process. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Women from the Faith Mediators Network from the East African and the Great Lakes regions met with members of the National Dialogue Steering Committee and other national officials to push for more women representation as the country moves toward a new transitional government. Ugandan Betty Bigombe, who chairs the group, says she realizes the revitalized peace agreement is not perfect, but says South Sudanese should embrace it in order to achieve peace.
There's skepticism, but it's up to you, us, and everybody in the region to make sure that it succeeds, to make sure that we shame those who are skeptical about the agreement.
Bigombe says women must be allowed to fully participate in implementing the agreement and governing the country at all levels.
This peace is not just for South Sudan. This peace for all of us in the region. It goes beyond the Great Lakes region. It goes beyond East Africa. The war in South Sudan has affected us economically, socially, and security-wise. So we are here to celebrate this, but also to make sure that it is implemented properly, and also to make sure that women are part and parcel of the implementation.
The National Dialogue Steering Committee says the 6 months consultations it conducted across South Sudan culminated in its draft report entitled The People Have Spoken. Angelo Beda, co-chair of the committee, says their report was shared with President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar. Beda says the report brought to light what ordinary people are going through, something he says had not been addressed in the revitalized peace agreement.
Not even 80% of the problems people are facing, like the proliferation of arms in southern Sudan. How will you get rid of it? This agreement does not touch it.
Beda says the dialogue committee will conduct regional conferences beginning early next year. He's calling on the SPLM-AIO and other opposition parties to participate in the dialogue. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
The U.S. government recently announced it will evoke Mauritania's AGOA trade status, which allows eligible African countries to benefit from trade preferences for certain products made in Africa. The U.S. government said Mauritania is not making enough progress towards combating slavery. Human rights activist Baliou Koulibaly tells Ricky Stryer that while the Mauritanian government has improved the legal framework in recent years to end slavery, the practice continues.
On the ground, we realize that all these laws and regulations are made for the international consumption. In practice, nothing has changed. The international funding, instead of helping the slave, reinforces considerably the power of the slave owners, maintaining the slaves under their control and threatening those who pretend to be free. So as a concrete example, the national agency supposed to help fighting against slavery, TADAMU, is chaired by someone who is directly involved in recent slavery practices in his home village. So all the high positions in Mauritania are attributed on feudal basis. They can be white or black African.
The U.S. president's announcement that they will disqualify Mauritania from AGOA, is this a positive step for the fight against forced labor in Mauritania?
We do appreciate it a lot because it will prevent Mauritania from using the American people money to contribute to injustice and slavery. It is, a very strong signal to Mauritania and even to other countries like Mali, where the slavery practices are still going, and to be sanctioned because they don't respect, their commitment.
Has there been any reaction on the ground from the Mauritanian government to this announcement?
In fact, there is no official reaction. But some people, the civil society activists and the independent people, do agree with this because they know that most of the time, the international funding are just used Okay, slavery, fighting against slavery is just a mean of getting international funding in order to reinforce those who are in power, and those who are in power are most of the time feudal people, and they still maintain people on slavery, either black or white.
Do you think this will impact small business owners who maybe aren't in the government, who will then lobby toward the government for them to make more progress to end slavery?
Yes, it will anyway, because most of the funding are not used for the purpose that they are dedicated for. So if the funding comes, instead of helping the poor, they reinforce the slave owners. They reinforce the feudal people. So it is good to avoid them getting their funds in order to help them to be more powerful. Maybe it will impact negatively some slaves, but it will. The slaves are suffering, and unfortunately they will suffer for a long time if there is no democratic and objective governance.
That was Baliol Coulibaly, spokesperson for the Collective Against Slavery in Soninke Communities. He was speaking to Ricky Schreier from Noah Church. Turnout was high across the country in Tuesday's United States midterm elections. All 435 seats in the House of Representatives were up for grabs, and 35 of 100 Senate seats, along with a number of state offices and ballot issues. The United States Department of State has invited 49 observers from Africa and other parts of the world to observe the U.S. midterm elections. Zimbabwean Solomon Bismarck Bobo Sibono is one of those observers.
I'm here under the International Exchange Leadership Program, which is supported by the U.S. Department of State. This program exposes us to the American electoral system, and it also allows us to share among the different countries that are represented here. I think we have got about 49 different nationalities under this particular program, where we are learning about the U.S. electoral process.
You have observed elections in Zimbabwe and some parts of Africa. What can the continent learn from these elections in America?
I think basically the systems are different in different states in America. But what Zimbabwe and the rest of Africa and the rest of the world can actually learn is the transparency within which this process is actually conducted, and also the issue of accountability back to the citizens. Openness to the citizens and then accountability to the citizens, as opposed to accountability and transparency to the authorities that run the elections or those that appoint the people that sit in the different electoral commissions.
So how do you think this will help Zimbabwe, your mission here? How are you going to ensure that you share what you have observed?
I think because of the various interactions that we have and the different platforms that we share with both the Electoral Commission of Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission, the non-profit organizations, political parties, I think that's what we are starting to think about. How then do we engage with those particular institutions so that we infuse some of these values?
Solomon Bismarck Bobo Sibono of Zimbabwe was one of many observers invited by the U.S. State Department to observe the U.S. midterm elections. He was speaking with VOA Zimbabwe service reporter Blessing Zulu from North Carolina. That is it for this Wednesday, November 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We invite you to join us again tomorrow for more Africa news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good day.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.